Hey, welcome to CKUT. You're listening to 90.3 FM. Really excited to be here. You're listening to STEMinism, a monthly show about current topics in neuroscience and listening to some music along the way. My name is Allie, and I'm joined by some great people, if you want to introduce yourselves.
Aww. My name is Amelie.
And my name is Noor, and we're all students of neuroscience, PhD students at McGill University, and we're so excited to talk about science here.
We also have another special guest. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi. I don't know if my mic is on. I don't think it is. Okay, it is. Hi. My name is Carla. I'm a student of political science, also at McGill, and I'm an undergrad.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you here and to get your input on everything as well. This is also my first time teching, so apologies if anything's a little bit glitchy. Really stoked to have Carla here because she's helping me as well, so thanks. Oh,
we're sure you'll do great.
We'll try. Sure. You just listened to A Présent?
Yeah,
A Présent. By Jonathan Persson. I really like that song.
Yeah, it's
really
nice.
Nice, like, little opener. Yeah, good pick for, like, a Friday afternoon, nice and chill on this kind of muggy day, so, yeah.
Yeah. This afternoon, we thought we'd talk about open science. The reason it's, like, an important topic in general, and especially now, is that there has been some drama in the science community.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this neuroscience journal, one of the very prestigious, high-ranking ones, called NeuroImage. They're focused on, like, brain imaging research. And they're published by one of the biggest publishers, at least in, like, health science and biology. I'm not sure if they do anything else. They're called Elsevier. And I think a month ago, the whole editorial board of NeuroImage just decided to quit, which is a big deal. It's 40 people who on Twitter announced, like, we're leaving. And the reason for this was that they've been fighting for years for Elsevier to lower their publishing fees. And Elsevier just announced that they're not going to do that. Instead, they're even increasing the publishing fees for, like, a sub-journal of NeuroImage, the NeuroImage Reports, I think. So for anyone who's not a published scientist and hasn't gone through the process, most journals will charge you a fee to publish your article if you want to make it open science. Like, often if you want to just publish it and then people have to pay in order to view it, your journal will let you do that for free because they get their money from the readers or, like, the university that subscribes to the journal. But if you want to make it open access, then you have to pay the fees so the journal gets its profit.
And yeah, the fees can get ridiculously high. Like, we're talking thousands of dollars per paper. And, like, cumulatively for, let's say, a lab, that's a sizable amount of, like, a research grant that they get.
Exactly. Like, for example, one of the biggest neuroscience journals, Nature, or science journals, actually. just forget about other science. One of the biggest science journals, Nature, they charge over $11,000 per article if you want to make it open access.
Yeah.
It's like how much my student debt is.
Absolutely. No, seriously. And you know what's funny? It's that the Nature themselves posted an article about this whole NeuroImage resignation thing. And it's like they were being, it's so funny. It's like, yeah, you guys are being the platform to report about this. Please take a look in the mirror. $11,000 for one article for an open access fee.
Yeah. And you have to imagine, like, you've worked years on that article. You've put in years of hours and, like, work and your salary and research money into that article, and then you have to pay even more to get it out there.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. And for NeuroImage, the fee is about $3,400, which is a bit less, but still, like, it's more than we make a month. I'm just saying.
Yep, absolutely. It's very crazy. Yeah,
you have to be part of an institution to pay those fees in the first place. So like if you're maybe part of a newer lab that has less funding, it might be harder to publish, I feel like, mm-hmm. if you don't have the funds to pay those open access fees. Or if you're in the lab with that situation, then you can't open, or you can't publish your work open access, mm-hmm. yeah. which is, I think all science should be open access.
Yeah. Yes. And ironically, it's more important to publish for like younger labs because they have a, like they're on a time crunch to publish as much as possible, but they also don't have as much funding as like very established labs have. So for them, it's like, even more difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, there are some ways to combat this. So I think what the editorial board did was amazing. They all resigned and they're going to start their own open access journal. I think they're going to call it Imaging Neuroscience yeah. or Neuroscience Imaging yeah. or something, yeah,
something
like that.
Something similar.
Yeah, via the MIT Press, which is yeah. great. Mm-hmm. Another thing though, like for smaller labs, if you want to make your own impact in this, there are a few things you can do. Like you can publish your preprint, for example, or on a bioarchive.
Yeah.
You can also have like a section on your lab website where you put those articles for people to read, like you know, like you upload them, and because technically it is your paper, so you're allowed to do that. And there's also every university, I think, well, every first world university would probably has like a website like for that university where you can upload all kinds of papers. So at McGill, the same place where you will find everyone's thesis proposals and their like basically all their thesis documents, you can also publish like papers there. And this shouldn't get you in trouble with the people you originally published your paper with, because technically it's still within the university. So that way you can get away with having your paper out there without having to pay the open access fee. So there are some things you can do to combat this.
That's really good to know.
It's really amazing that the editorial board took this yeah. step, because yeah. it's more than just the fee. It's about making a statement. Like, you cannot keep restricting science to a very particular class of people who can afford this stuff.
Yeah, I really appreciate the gesture. Yeah. Honestly, well done, editorial board. Thank you.
Apparently, their new journal has already over 400 applications for reviewers.
Ooh.
So it's people are recognizing their yeah. the statement. So I think that's good as well.
Yeah, I feel a bit bad for anyone who submitted an article just before they quit, because yeah. Like, it's very stressful that you're not sure what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. With the article, but I think they agreed to have everything like still published that's been accepted until then.
Yeah,
but yeah.
What about the articles in process? Do you know, like, will they take it themselves, or maybe they'll give the choice to the
that would be awesome
people. Like, hey, by the way, the editorial board changed. Do you want to still stick with us? Yeah. I think Elsevier will try to fight back though.
Yeah, you know? That would yeah. be a nice slap in the face of Elsevier though, when like everyone retracts their article and just goes with another journal.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I mean, they make billions of dollars a year. Like, they don't need yeah. to be charging this much money for their open access fee. Like, they're fine, they're good.
Yeah,
wait, they make how much money?
Like, I think over $1 billion a year. 1.8 yeah. is what Ed said in yes. our meeting today, I think. Yeah. like they do not need to be charging this much money for people to make their articles open access. It's
I
just
feel really bad for the people who like write articles and have to pay those fees. Because I remember I had a friend in CGEP. She just could not get access to an article, even though like we were in CGEP, so she should have access to it. So yeah. what she did is she emailed the author of the article mm-hmm. and he sent it to her.
I had to do that too.
Yeah.
I was writing my undergrad thesis, and I went to a really small university that didn't have most of the subscriptions. And there were, I think, 80 articles that I wanted to use in my thesis. And so I had to email my sister, who was at a bigger university, to try to find some of the articles. And the ones that she couldn't find, I then had to like email the author directly for mm-hmm. them to send it to me. And only like half of them sent it to me directly.
We have a whole Slack channel in our lab at McGill University. Like, this is a big university with a lot of money, a lot of subscriptions. And we have a whole Slack channel where people like post papers and like, can you download this for me? Does anyone have yeah. access here?
Yeah. Yeah. It's really crazy. It's yeah. so crazy. The amount, the fact that the people who are producing the science have to struggle to access that same science that their own community is producing.
Yeah. It's just insane. It tells you how much dear God, how far open science has to advance.
Absolutely.
I think it's growing now, and at least most researchers are aware of it, which is already like a step, but we're still so far away from like everything just being accessible.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, like, science is for the elite. Like, yeah. Only those who can afford it, really.
Yeah, those who can afford it, or those who are lucky enough to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And even, like, the people who are not part of the elite and are doing science are constantly shrouded by this shadow of instability, because they're not sure if they'll be able to make a living out of this. They don't know if they'll be able to sustain this kind of lifestyle for themselves, or if they have a family. Like, it gets really difficult for them. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, there's so many layers to all of this. It's more than just like a publishing fee. There's so many layers to all of this, like the restriction of science.
And the other thing too, like, kind of going off that, like, the whole idea of open science, I think, is also a lack of access to people's data as well. Mm-hmm. Like, I know people who have worked in labs where the data was quite questionable, and the methods of collecting the data was questionable, and the statistics themselves were questionable, but you don't have access to that data. You have to actually reach out to the correspondents of the articles themselves to request access to their data, and then they can, like, often deny. They don't have to give access, and I think that data should be attainable.
Oh, absolutely.
And then the next issue is that even if you have published your data on, like, a database, and it is in theory accessible, often it's in a really weird software that, like, I had one situation where even the postdoc I worked with, who's been in the field for like over 10 years or something, she could not figure out how to access the data, although it was there. And then like, once we got the file, it was absolutely unreadable. And often it's like,
it's almost like they're trying to hide something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's like really bad quality and not uniform. And then we always have the issue that every lab does it differently. So like, your tables will look different, and it's going to be such a pain just to figure out what their data looks like and what everything means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's so important to learn, like, from the very beginning. Like, now we're all at the beginning stages of our PhDs, right? So it would be great for us to start advocating for good data practices. Like, from the beginning, we have we use open source languages, we use open source softwares that won't go extinct within a year or two, and we learn how to properly label all our data and our files. And we should also try to do something called pre-registration. Is very important to it. Basically, you write your claim and your plan for the data that you're going to collect, and you submit that. You submit that to like a journal or something, so that now it's like on the record. It doesn't get published yet, and like, so that way you can still protect the science, you know, so you don't get scooped by someone else. But it allows you to have a validity and like, yeah, like, this is what I plan to do and this is what I ended up doing, rather than coming up with a hypothesis after you have collected the data and then modifying your hypothesis to conveniently fit the data so that you can get a publication.
Yeah, that happens too often.
Yeah.
One question. Do you guys keep a lab book?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, awesome. Because I have worked in labs where that is not a thing.
Me too. I've worked in labs where that's just not a thing at all.
It's either like an online lab book, so like a Google Drive, mm-hmm. where you every day you update it, or like right now in my current rotation, every student has a lab notebook, and you're recommended to leave notes on it every day, even if you didn't do anything significant that day, you can like write what you did. It's good to get in the habit of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Even just like my to-dos, like the smallest thing, like, oh, I need to remember to like take this thing out of this box that just arrived. Like the smallest things, I write everything in it just because I don't know.
I do find it a bit hard to keep one for like the kind of research I do now.
Yeah, you have, I would.
Just sitting on my computer and looking at neuroimaging data.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to write your code and like adjust it and then absolutely forget about what you did yesterday. And it's like, it's the same thing every day kind of, but it all meshes into one thing.
Yeah, that's very true. And I get
kind of annoyed by it myself.
Yeah, that's. I feel like that kind of research is much harder to keep a lab book. Like, I found it a lot easier to keep a lab book pretty up to date when I'm working in a wet lab, because it's so much easier to just write down something.
Yeah.
Because you're not near your laptop necessarily.
True, and also there's usually something that you have to do every day, right? Like, today I have to do these injections, or I have to do these electroporations, or I have to do this and that. Or I have to order this chemical, or you have these things that you have to do, like, because you have cells on a dish that might die if you don't do it. So it's very urgent. If you're working with human data where sometimes you get subjects, sometimes you don't, it's not really the same type of landscape.
Yeah. I think my humans aren't going to die if I don't.
Yeah. If you don't analyze their data in like the next half hour, they're fine.
Hopefully. Yes. Yeah. No, tadpoles are way more flimsy, I can tell you that.
Yeah, my exploding worms. Not a fan of them. Just kidding.
Yeah. Hey, what are you doing your PhD in? Oh, worms, tadpoles. It's like, that's so important.
Yeah, sure.
What do you say? I just scraped goo off my plate all day.
Gross.
Should we listen to a song?
Yeah, I have one cued, and then I was going to play one by you next, if that's cool.
Oh, perfect. Yes.
This one is just like sciencey themed. I don't know if the song itself is. I just like the title. It's called Centrifuge.
Let's go for it.
By Pomplamoose.
There's smoke passing gray.
right, we're back. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, currently listening to the show STEMinism. All right. We had a really cool topic by Carla. Did you want to introduce it? I'm really excited about this.
Sure. So I was on TikTok because I spent a lot of time on there, and someone was explaining this big, like, drama that happened in the math community a few years ago. So basically, there's a professor. His name is, wait, let me just, like, read it. Shinichi Mochizuki of Kyoto University, and he's, like, very well respected in the field of math. And he basically published a 500-page paper on how to solve what he calls inter-universal Tick-Mueller theory. I have no idea what that is.
Sounds like a made-up word.
Know what that is. Easy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Sounds like AI made that up.
Yeah, but he's like, oh, I was able to solve this problem that, you know, people for years and centuries, they have not been able to solve. I was able to solve it, and he publishes this 500-page paper. And people start complaining, hey, I don't understand your methodology, and I don't understand how you gathered this proof or how you came to this conclusion. So then he publishes another paper where it's like how to read this so that then you could read my other paper to understand what I did in it. And then two professors at Oxford, they were like, okay, you know what, we're gonna try to like go through this. And they went through it and they were like, hey, there's a bunch of errors in this. I'm not, like, not disrespecting you because, you know, you're very respected in the field, but I'm telling you as a colleague, I feel like this needs revision. And he's very adamant on the fact that it does not need revision, that his proof is perfect, and that his paper, there's nothing wrong with it.
Okay, question. Did the thing not get peer reviewed?
I think, from what I understand, he, like, published it on his own website. It
wasn't, like, yeah. Yeah,
500 pages is a lot. That's a whole manifesto.
It's like narcissism right there. Yeah. He's got some personality disorder. He's undiagnosed. Yeah. Maybe he is diagnosed and he just didn't share that.
Yeah. But the article on The New Scientist, it says, if nobody understands a mathematical proof, does it count?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Does it count if no one can understand it? You can even ask the same question about, like, all fields of science, be it social or natural or otherwise. Like, does it, what's the point of you doing all of this if you're not able to properly communicate it to the public?
That's like, true.
Yeah. And especially if they get really defensive about it after, when there's criticism, like, there will always be criticism about something. And it's a good thing, right? It's a good thing to have the discussion and the dialogue and, like, exchange, and other people have different perspectives. So it's a good thing.
Yeah.
And to be like, yeah, no, I'm right and you're wrong, and not even, like, try to communicate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, like, just reminds me of professors who aren't the greatest at, like, explaining their fields.
Oh, that happens.
And then and when everyone fails a test, they think that there's something wrong with that the group of kids in their class.
Yeah, it's like, those damn phones. Or
Yeah, exactly. It's TikTok.
Yeah. It can't be me being a horrible teacher. No.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Even if most of the class failed. No, I'm sure I did a fantastic job. It's the self-importance. It's the idea that as a scientist, you're trying to make yourself great. People lose focus of the science itself. And, like, in the end, what you're supposed to be looking for is the truth, or you're trying to understand something. Or in the case of math, some people say that you discover it, some people say that you create it, but there is a certain thing to discover, because there is a right and a wrong, and there can be flaws in your proof. So if you feel like you figured it out and someone told you that, hey, there's a mistake, as someone who is seeking the truth or seeking this knowledge, you should be happy that someone brought this to your attention, and you should address it. You shouldn't be afraid of that, because then you're making the math about yourself and about how great of a mathematician you are. And you don't even care about it enough if you're not even going to consider the criticism that someone is bringing to your attention.
Yeah. But I think, unfortunately, there are a lot of people in all sorts of fields at this higher level more for that clout than the actual search for knowledge, I guess. Like, it's in any field, anywhere, you're going to find people like that, which is...
Absolutely, yeah.
Kind of a bummer.
It's sad. And it's also, somehow, it's always these people that end up making it to the higher positions, because they're always, you know, you need to put yourself out there, and you have to, like, stand up and say, hey, I'm good at this, or I'm an expert in that. But I find that most people tend to be shy, and they'll always say, yeah, but I'm not sure, and I don't have enough experience, and you never know enough. And the people who are, like, overconfident will end up stepping over your toes. And
yeah. But that's what we learn mm-hmm. at university, right? We learn to be really humble and, like, question ourselves and look at everything from multiple angles, because there could be something, like, wrong with your conclusion mm-hmm. that you just didn't see. There is a certain neuroscience podcaster out there, a very famous one that shall remain unnamed, that I really don't agree with. And he is one of those people who's, like, just very good at talking, and I don't think anything he puts out there is super, like, science based or, like, backed up by actual research. And it makes me very mad every time I see his podcasts.
we're not gonna proceed to name names here, yeah. But yeah, just putting this out there.
That's pretty funny. Yeah. Don't want to make big enemies here.
Yeah.
Do you guys feel in science you have, like, sometimes difficulty, like, verbalizing your, like, really complex idea to the point where, like, other people can understand what you're saying? Because I realized that I was talking to my dad about, like, something that was, like, comms related, and I realized, oh, what I'm saying to him is gibberish. I need to, like...
Oh, for sure.
Yes.
I remember in my master's, we had two exams that were, like, where we had to formulate a research proposal, and we had to make a summary in, like, scientific terms and one summary in lay terms. And the one in lay terms was the one where we had the worst grades, and our professor said that's always, like, the worst section, because we're too in our heads to remember what normal people, like, know and which terms are too much. So that's an issue.
It's
a very valuable skill to learn.
Sorry I interrupted you. I was just gonna say, I actually just didn't get a scholarship that I was hoping to get because I think I wasn't able to write it in, like, normal terms enough.
That sucks. I'm sorry.
It's fine. I'm not, like, sad about it. I mean, I'm sad about it, but not that sad about it. But the whole thing was, like, I didn't take enough time trying to write it in a way that was more understandable to the general public, and it wasn't scientists reading the scholarship application. Mm-hmm. And I really think that's a big reason why I didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that's something I definitely need to work on.
Yeah. And, like for me, I think it even comes down to, like, even when it's not complex scientific stuff, even simple stuff, I'm, like, the first person in my family to go to university. So a lot of the times when, like, I'm discussing things related to academics, like, things about courses and stuff, it's sometimes difficult. Like, my parents would be asking me about something, and I'd have to explain something that, you know, people who go to, you know, like, had gone to university in their lives would immediately catch on to. But you find yourself having to explain, like, the entire systems, like, okay, so basically this is how the course system works. You have these things that you have to take and these requirements. It's so crazy. Like, you always assume that people know, and that you just really have to think about where people are coming from. Like, a lot of the times they won't know. And then this, when they ask me, like, hey, how was your week? What did you do? I never know what to tell my parents, you know? It's so difficult. I'm always like, yeah, it was a good week at the lab. How will I explain to my mother that I was injecting specific viruses into the tectum of a tadpole that's developing to see the... Like, I can't even fathom how I would start explaining that. And so one nice thing that we do is when I have the time, usually once a week, to, like, have a long conversation with her, we sit down and I, like, try to explain this. So I'm like, okay, so you know how, like, the frogs, when they make tadpoles and they're really small. So what I do is I do this and I do that. And I try to use, like, really approachable terms. And it does help. But it does make you realize how far away language can make you feel, like, from the people around you, or just from people in different fields. Like, language is way more important than we scientists give it credit to. Like, the language that we use to communicate our ideas and the way we express them is infinitely important. It's so important, just as important as the science itself. And that's something I've realized with time.
Yeah, absolutely. And also an aspect of this is that most science is in English.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I'm German. So a lot of English words just don't have a German equivalent to it. So I have to like switch to English to explain my research to people. But then it's like a double problem because they're not going to understand the English. And then it's a weird term anyway. And it makes me sound like a complete idiot who's just showing off her great language skills.
Yeah,
but it is a big thing.
Yeah. Like for me with Arabic too, with my mom, like same thing. It's like, I don't even know how to say the, like most of, like a whole sentence, a few words only I can translate. Yeah. And maybe it's because of my own lack of proficiency. Like maybe I'm not well versed enough in.
Well, we also didn't learn all those terms in our mother language, like in our
true. We did not. Language. Yeah.
So it's only in there in English.
Yep. No, that's very true.
Another thing that I get asked a lot is like, I can't even imagine what your lab looks like. Like whenever you say you go to the lab in the morning, I imagine you in like a lab coat and goggles and syringes around there. And
that's pretty that's funny.
Just not it.
That's me.
At least for me.
Yeah.
Depends on the lab.
Like I wish I was one of those people who looks all cool the whole coat situation. But I'm a boring person who just sits in front of her computer all day in a very normal office. I always tell people like we have brains in jars on ourselves just to make it seem a bit more exciting.
Yeah, cadavers.
And people actually believe that.
Oh my god, they do. Wow.
Technically, there are a bunch there where you work at the Douglas.
Yeah, I think they're one floor up, though. Yeah. So I'd have to take a walk over there.
Yeah. I did learn a morbid fact about them, though, today that I didn't know before.
Yeah, that's just sad.
Yeah.
Just for reference, there's like a whole brain bank of people who donated their brains to science, like at the Douglas Mental Health Institute. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They died very sadly, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
On a more positive note, did you guys hear about the peer pub website or pub peer? I've never shown
it. No, I don't know what that is.
It's a website where like scientists can comment on published articles as like a peer review process, but the actual peer review that the article has to go through in order to be published. And you can start a whole discourse about the article, and it's like actually really constructive, I feel.
Yeah.
And it's a good exercise even for us to like learn what not to do sometimes.
Absolutely. And like that way, when you're looking up an article, before you use that as your reference, you could maybe take a look to see what other people thought about it. Because oftentimes when we first read an article, in the first sweep, you'll take everything that they said is like, oh yeah, that makes sense, that's true. Because whenever you feel like you don't understand something that they did, you'll just say it was probably because I'm not familiar. Mm-hmm. But then when the second time you look at that article after you're familiar, you'll realize, okay, wait, this makes absolutely no sense. This figure is wrong. This conclusion does not add up with what they were saying. And that enables you to be more critical and to know like the type of literature you're dealing with.
We had a whole discussion about one article in my lab last week where they just cropped some data points out of their figures. And I would have never noticed unless like people pointed it out. Like I don't even know how you notice that, but they just saw from the first look at that figure. And I want to get to that point at some point.
Are you allowed to do that? To crop
data? No, why we had the discussion about it. No. It's very sketchy.
Yeah.
Don't remove people randomly without reporting it. That's the thing. You can remove outliers if they drive your whole correlation, for example. Like if there's two people who are like very far up in their values, whatever. You can remove them, but you have to report it in your paper and say, like, that's what we did, and that's why we did it and how we did it.
Mm-hmm. You can't just pretend the data never existed.
Yeah. Yes.
Because otherwise people would just remove all the data that doesn't fit their story and get perfect correlations all the time.
Yep. Yeah. It's kind of manufacturing your own data, and we don't do that.
Yeah.
In theory.
Yeah, we shouldn't
again,
do that.
No name dropping.
Well, let's play another song. This is Nora's recommendation. We're going to play Thinking of You by The Night Six.
Exciting.
We're back. Again, you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. You're tuned into STEMinism. Yep.
Absolutely. And One thing that I want to bring up in relation to open science is kind of going beyond the scope of open science and looking at science and community, science and art. There's this amazing initiative that was established here in Montreal called Convergence, which aims to bridge the gap between science, art, and society to make art more approachable for scientists and make science more approachable for artists. It's amazing. They have like a course that they offer for like both McGill neuroscience students to take and Concordia design students to take. I took the course. It was pretty amazing. And I really love their activities. They have a bunch of events and talks. They do a lot of community events where people can collaborate. And it's definitely a great resource if you're just, you know, like someone who does not happen to be a grad student in a science context and you want to feel more involved in science, or if you are a scientist and you want to branch out into art and you want to give your science more meaning beyond the numbers and the statistics and the publications, but you want to situate your science into the community and what it means to people, then it's definitely the place, like a go-to place. So if you check out info, let me get the website, actually. I'll get that real quick, but
shout
definitely
out to the Convergence course.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I checked out the Convergence courses, like end of semester installation courses, installation.
Yeah. The Convergence initiative, like the Convergence initiative, symposium that we had.
That was really cool. Yeah. The exhibit was actually really, really cool. I was really impressed. It makes me like maybe want to take the class now.
You should. I highly recommend it. The website, by the way, is called convergenceinitiative.org. So if you're interested in checking them out, I highly recommend. You could learn all about the courses that they offer, the events and stuff like that. I've had a lot of fun. It's so cool. Like you start with a research paper and you end up with an art exhibit. It's so cool. It's
such
so, like,
a cool idea.
It's an amazing idea. I really loved it, and it makes you appreciate your science in different ways because you're not just thinking about, okay, I need to do this and this. These are the statistics, and I need to submit to this, and I need to apply for this grant. But rather, this is what my science would, how it would impact my community. This is what it means. Even if it's not necessarily translational, your science does not have to be translational for you to be involved in this course in a meaningful way. Like it's pretty good.
I saw one of the projects at a school event that I volunteered for, and they made a board game out of language brain areas.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. Like I'm so like honestly jealous that they got to spend their time doing this for almost a year.
It's so amazing. Yeah, this was it's great. It's amazing. Claire Honda, she's a PhD student at the IPN, mm-hmm. and she worked on that project.
Yeah. And they had all these like action cards in there with different physiological processes that could affect like how your brain areas connect to process language. And it's really accessibly explained, even for kids, I feel. Like maybe not kindergarten kids, but I don't know, high school kids, maybe.
Yeah. I want them to actually like make it and sell it. It was one of the coolest ideas I've seen. It was so well executed. I was truly amazed.
Yeah.
What did you do for the course, Noor?
We worked on a dream interactive installation where it's basically taking the dream experience and abstracting it into like an art form. So when you dream, your brain consolidates your memories and it abstracts the information that you receive during the day into, you know, more abstract concepts. So we tried to replicate that in an interactive exhibit, and it went pretty well. It was pretty cool. I have some pictures I could show you after.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I dreamed about eating Nutella tonight.
Oh yeah. If you use our exhibit, you're going to see a ginormous tub of Nutella appear.
Oh my gosh.
Love it.
Dream come true.
Also, check out the sociability of sleep. It's another art initiative, which combines both artists and neuroscientists / psychologists, specifically in the context of sleep, which I think is super cool.
It's very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right, well, maybe we can just play some songs.
All right. Can I announce the next
song? Yes, please do.
We're going to listen to Mon Amour by Deville. I'm never sure how to pronounce that. It was a recommendation from my best friend, so thank you a lot, Zaid.
Super excited.
And I hope you guys enjoy the song.
Yes. Apologize for the random pausing. There's technical issues. More just me being technical issue.
You just listened to a slightly interrupted version.
I apologize. We have a few minutes left. You've been tuned in to Steminism with CKUT, listening to 90.3 FM. Really thank you all so much for tuning in. We really appreciate it. This is, again, going to be a monthly show. Look back in June and tune
also,
in again.
If anyone has something they want to talk about or want us to talk about with our vast knowledge,
feel free to reach out. Yeah, we appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening.
And have a STEMmy day.
Yeah, the most STEMmy day. And have a great weekend. We're going to play one final song. It's by Clay and Friends, which is a Montreal band. They're amazing. Go check them out. This song is called Going Up the Coast.
Pack my bag up, take her home. Never homesick down the road. In my room by the moon with no ceiling. I was driving in a van that was older than I+5, heading Kanye West off the tip of Argentina. Better than drowning engine, ain't got no sick to blame instead of my reflection. So I dreamt, I packed it all like Anderson to end up where it all began. I was going up the coast in a minivan that broke, like my voice when I told you I was leaving. Packed my bag up, sick of home, never homesick down the road. In my room by the moon with no ceiling. Just don't wanna live in Brooklyn, with a view from my apartment. No more homies on the block, like, on the corner like a stoplight. I'm a ghost, they never lose, hey. Never should've put a show pace. Took it back at the beginning, when I knew when I was singing, yeah. I was going up the coast in a minivan that broke, like my voice when I told you I was leaving. Packed my bag up, sick of home, never homesick down the road. In my room by the moon with no ceiling.
You're my diamond, babe. CKUT 90.3 FM.
MTL 2424 presents Nonstop, a 36-hour continuous dance marathon celebrating nightlife culture, a first in Canada. It starts on Friday night, May 19th at 10 p.m. and ends on Sunday, May 21st at 8 a.m. at the Grand Quay of the Port of Montreal. On the program, 15 of the most exciting DJs from here and abroad, such as VTSS, Jacques Green, DJ Minx, TSVI, Kiernan Laveau, and more. In addition, there will be a free outdoor stage on Saturday, May 20th. Hurry, places are limited. Tickets available at mtl2424.ca. MTL 2424, another night is possible.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Je t'embrasse un instant furtif, l'ombre de ton ombre dans la chambre, toute cette...